I think one of my favorite all-time memes is the one that says, you know, the adults ask the kids, why are they depressed and sad and what's going on? And kids say, well, here's all the things that's wrong with the world. We've got a climate crisis and we were in a Trumpian kind of world and all these things. And the adults go, yeah, so it's the iPhones, isn't it? And it's not entirely the iPhones. It's much more than the iPhones, but the iPhones become the fall guy for all the other proverbial hitting the fan around the world.
Welcome to Freedom Matters, where we explore the intersection of technology, productivity, and digital well-being. I'm your host, Georgie Powell, and each week I'll be talking to experts in productivity and digital wellness. I'll be asking them three questions to get to the heart of what productivity means to them. This week, I'm in conversation with Jocelyn Brewer, a psychologist, teacher, and human who helps individuals and organisations be well-connected and mentally fit. It is now nearly a decade since she coined the term digital nutrition, and today we'll be discussing how that concept remains relevant, why gaming is a superfood, the challenges of urban geography, and just why the media will dictate our future. Jocelyn, I have been a huge fan of yours since I first started working in this sector. I am so glad to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us on Freedom Matters.
It's always fun to chat.
So you initially coined the concept of digital nutrition. And I think you did that around 8 years ago now, definitely a pioneer in this field. And obviously in the last 8 years, technology has changed quite a lot. And I'm interested to understand from you how you think your concept of digital nutrition has either evolved or whether it's still relevant, given that the technology landscape has changed quite a lot in that time too.
Sure. Yeah. Look, it has been since about 2013 that this kind of popped out of my mouth, really in response to the rise of the conversation around digital detoxing and the whole notion that technology is toxic and we should go on some kind of radical diet and restrict it, which to me just seemed really ridiculous and unsustainable, like many of the diets I've ever actually tried. So it really was born out of the fact that we have such literacy around our you know, food diet, that it made much more sense to me to start helping parents understand it from that same perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think what I've noticed in the last 8 years is that we are finally at the point where we're ready to ditch just screen time and we're more interested in virtual vitamins and the nutritional benefits that are around. So I'm glad that people are cottoning onto that.
So in your world, what do you view as those good calories versus the bad calories and the things to avoid? Are you prescriptive in that?
No, I'm not, because again, the other aspect to this is the human being that brings their particular sensitivities and personality and temperament to their digital world. So, mm-hmm. you know, for anyone who has more than one child, you will know how different those two children can be. They may not like the same foods and they may not be engaged in the same technology. So some kids have a more needy personality where them being on technology might, you know, not be as healthy as another kid who is naturally more of an outdoors kid. It's not about prescribing this is good and this is bad, but more looking at the principles of general well-being in context where screen time fits or screen-based media use fits in the family's fabric. The other thing that I'm starting to talk more and more about is the cognitions that go with tech use. So generally mm-hmm. kids are now aware of this, like what is healthy and what is less healthy, but mm-hmm. it's more about, am I thinking in a healthy way about what I'm consuming? So if mm-hmm. I'm scrolling through lots of social media, am I applying media literacy or some sort of social and emotional awareness to what I'm seeing? Mm-hmm. Can I separate myself from the Insta celebrities and the over-filtered humans that we're presented with to actually understand the difference between that and real life and not kind of judging yourself or having negative self-esteem and those sorts of things because of the way that that's being presented. So that's a whole nother bunch of coconuts, like the cognitions. How do we compare the cognitions of, you know, two teenage girls looking at body image stuff? How do we work out what's adaptive and maladaptive? And again, none of the research is really asking those questions. It's still like, how long are you on social media? Oh, are you anxious and depressed?
Yes.
Really blunt ways of doing research in 2021.
And what about gaming? Because when we first met, I remember thinking, okay, Jocelyn is the first person I've spoken to in this space who is so pro gaming. So tell me a bit about how you think about gaming and amongst families and young people.
I think gaming is different because it is something that you can do together more easily. So it's hard to sort of sit around a social media feed and participate in that. Whereas mm-hmm. a game is obviously something that is created to play generally together. And I noticed that families who maybe where parents have been gamers or are more willing to put their toe in the digital playground, there are better relationships there. Gaming is such an unknown thing. If we make a comparison to books, we would never say to kids, please go over in the corner and read your book and don't interrupt me and please keep it to yourself. Whereas with games, it's such an other thing. Like, oh, I don't get it. I don't really want to get it. And I'm not interested in building a bridge to understanding your world. So what I guess my home play for many parents who come to my talks is really to practice trying to spend some time in that gaming space and to uncover the delights that have their kids stay so engaged. I mean, you know, parents are like, oh my God, they won't get off the game. I'm like, wow, tell me why. Tell me what's happening in that game that is something that you would do for 6 hours straight and almost wet your pants before you stop and go to the toilet. So bringing curiosity to a lot of that rather than kind of shame and just invalidating their choice of leisure activities.
Yeah.
I think gaming is a digital superfood. I did my TEDx talk in 2015 all about the idea that playing games really foster some of the thinking skills that many people lament are missing in young people. So critical and creative thinking, for instance.
Do you like naming the games that do that or not really?
Look, any game can do that because I can play Grand Theft Auto and not have to engage in any of the violence in order to get points, right? I'm not really interested in playing a game to win. I'm interested in playing Grand Theft Auto and exploring the city of Los Angeles. And, you know, as an ex-geography teacher, I'm really fascinated with urban environments. The resource that I commend, you know, the entire world to is Andy Robertson's Taming Gaming database. So it's taminggaming.com. He's spent his lockdown in the UK really creating this database, which is a beautiful example of the richness of games beyond some of those big names that you would know, you know, the blockbuster kind of games, so that we can diversify our digital diet into some of the beautifully designed, creative narratives, beautiful storytelling, accessible games, games that anyone with, you know, if you're on the spectrum or you're neurodivergent, you can really engage without some of the risks of overuse and obsession that come with. It's some of the games that have pervasive and persuasive design elements that are really designed to hook you in.
Technology is often blamed for some of the challenges of today's society, particularly the mental health issues experienced among teenagers. But as a former geographer, Jocelyn believes the causes may run a lot deeper than tech.
I guess I come at this again from a multidisciplinary perspective of being a geographer to begin with, who then became a teacher and then a psychologist. Yes, there are problems. I'm not a tech apologist. There are problems within the design of tech, which we know are playing upon our, you know, basic human needs. But alongside that are things like the way our built environment is changing, the fact that we're moving to much more high-density cities. In Sydney, we have a lot of schools who, because of the increase in the population, don't have green spaces. They actually have to roster kids and their year group into time outside in the playground. So you might get 1 or 2 days a week of your lunchtime that you're actually on the grass. No wonder kids sit on devices and find different ways to entertain themselves digitally, because we actually haven't planned for their other needs in, you know, high density living, not having green spaces, community spaces, all of that community infrastructure and capital that we really need. That whole sense of the village hasn't been planned back into some of these cities. The sociocultural stuff, I think, is really important. We're having, like the French, conversations over the right to disconnect and the right for workers to actually not be always on and not be checking their emails. And obviously, in a post-pandemic economic recovery where people and parents are obviously trying to hold on to their jobs and not become redundant or they're happy to work on reduced hours, i.e. reduced pay for the same number of hours. No wonder parents are sitting at the dinner table checking their email, being rarely responsive, making sure that they're not missing anything in order to please that boss. So there's all sorts of complexity beyond just the fact that technology is pervasive and persuasively designed and in all of our pockets and irresistible. I think one of my favorite all-time memes is the one that says, you know, the adults ask the kids, why are they depressed and sad and what's going on? And kids say, well, here's all the things that's wrong with the world. We've got a climate crisis and we were in a Trumpian kind of world and all these things. And the adults go, yeah, so it's the iPhones, isn't it? And it's not entirely the iPhones. It's much more than the iPhones, but the iPhones become the fall guy for all the other proverbial hitting the fan around the world. I think as adults, we have this utopian idea about how young people should access technology. They should learn with it and they should get all the right information and that should be engaging and inspiring. But then when it comes to leisure, we should really know how to put it down and have limits and learn how to self-regulate miraculously, even though the adults around us are probably not doing that particularly well. So even today, a really big study came out from the Gonski Institute of Education at the University of New South Wales that showed out of 2,000 parents that were interviewed, 9 out of 10 themselves indicated that they were digitally distracted. That's 90% of the sample of adults said, it's not just my kids, but it's me too. I can't put my phone down. And so how are we role modeling things to young people if we ourselves are now sucked into this kind of treadmill of got to keep on top of my emails, got to keep inbox zero, got to be really responsive, got to keep up with 17 channels of news and 15 different WhatsApp groups so that I can still be included, invited, and feel like a part of a community.
So and, of course, the podcast. Don't forget the podcast. Got to keep listening to those.
Don't forget the podcast, right? And that fear of missing out. What show should I be watching on one of the 7 streaming channels that are out there? You can never get to the bottom of it. It's lifetimes of content.
I was interested. Does Jocelyn have any personal strategies for managing tech overload?
I'm a really huge fan of Nir Eyal and his book Indistractable, which really changed my life in 2019 when he sent it to me and asked me to review it. I realized how little traction I was building with the stuff that mattered. And that values-aligned work that now is, again, quite central, along with the digital well-being kind of space exploding, that the pushing back on productivity porn and the cult of busy has coincided with that and coincided with people like Nir's work around this, where it's much more about being aligned to the stuff that really matters and noticing what distracts you and creates those internal and external triggers. I mapped beautifully onto all this stuff around toxic positivity and that whole good vibes only tribe. Well, no, it's actually sitting with the real crap times that we have globally experienced to go, it's not all unicorns and rainbows. It's sometimes really sucky and we have the skills as humans to deal with that.
It was becoming apparent to me that digital nutrition was not just about what you ate, but also about the context of consumption and the value set that went alongside it.
That's right. And so a lot of how I used to couch it was much more about your relationship with technology. So similarly to your relationship with food and disordered eating, not necessarily having an eating disorder, but disordered eating is when you're not actually present and mindful to not just the fact that you're putting energy into your face, but when you do it, why you do it, binge eating, emotional eating, like we emotionally scroll. It's the equivalent of emotional scroll. Emotional eating is that emotional scrolling. Anytime you're alone with your thoughts, you pick something up and you distract yourself or you soothe yourself. It's that relationship with technology, like your relationship with food and where that's appropriate. In most schools that I know, you can't sit and be eating a packet of chips while you're doing maths. You might be able to have your water bottle out, but you don't sit there eating your lunch in the middle of class. So similarly, why do we pick up our phone and start snacking in the middle of class? Well, you know, we could spend hours talking about why
phones
we do that.
In schools.
Phones in schools. That's a whole other, you know, conversation, which gets me usually very feeling.
Whilst we didn't have time for a full-blown discussion re phones in schools, the 2-minute summary went something like this.
It needs really clear, boundaries. It needs to be explicit, and it needs to have young people being a part of how those guidelines are made so that they have buy-in and they can understand how those rules were made and why those guidelines are there. Ask kids what they want. Invariably, kids actually say, yeah, we want some stricter rules around our phone use.
Yeah, they want the excuse to put them away.
They actually want somebody to give them that clear instruction, but they don't necessarily just want someone to come in over the top and without building that relationship, change the rules. Because schools then put a lot of energy into enforcing those rules, which ruins relationships. So you're back to a situation where deputy principals are enforcing rules rather than building relationships. Mm. And we know that relationships are what are the protective factors of reaching the kids most at risk.
Through the course of our conversation, we'd started to touch on some big themes: urban geography, inequality, education, all of which have a part to play in our relationship with technology. But looking forward, how did Jocelyn think these forces would play out? And would technology fall as a positive or a negative influence for our world?
Are we going to take the red pill or the blue pill? So much of the media really is the driving force behind this. While we have media companies who get to own the facts and get to work, really push out which facts get air and which don't, then there's always going to be a divide between how people choose to live their lives. And the people who have the skills to think beyond the information presented to them to go to trusted, verified sources of information, and the people who don't. Mm. So I think this will come down to our access and our critical thinking over the information that's presented to us. So I'll use an example again from the research that came out today. The research that came out today is from a very distinguished institute, and I have a lot of respect for them. But when you dig into the sample was really skewed. It was not representative of the Australian population. When you dig into what was presented in the conversation, one of the solutions out of the three solutions that were offered, one of which was very vague, like we need to have agreements and talk about technology use. The next thing that this professor suggested was that we had no devices in the bedroom and 2 hours of tech-free time before bed. Now, I've heard half an hour before bed, I've heard an hour before bed, but suddenly we're at 2 hours before bed, and I say to that very respectfully, where's the evidence for that?
Yeah.
And this is what I mean about information and misinformation and what do we trust and where do we critically appraise it. Distinguished professor coming up with 2 hours in a very widely read thing, there's not really harm in trying that. But I think it does make it very impossible for some families who go, I can't do that, therefore I'm failing. Therefore I'm going to give up on trying any other things to do with wrangling technology in my home because it all seems too bloody hard.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't want to, you know, ostracize parents or make them give up. And I see that regularly in parenting kind of commentators and people really shaming parents for not parenting hard enough and not saying no. Like, come on, it's so much more complex than that.
If our critical thinking skills and the ability to seek truth is at the heart of our future relationship with technology, then how will this play out across different sectors of society? I was interested in Australia's digital divide, not necessarily the first divide, enabling equitable access to technology, which of course is critical, but the second divide, that of ensuring all socioeconomic groups are equipped with the right toolkit to use technology in a life-enhancing way. How are the forces of inequality shaping Australia's relationship with technology?
It's a really good question, and I'm probably not up to date enough with it, but the Growing Up Digital report that I was referring to earlier did include a very small proportion of disadvantaged people. Again, it was skewed, so we didn't have enough information about that for my liking, I guess. But what it showed from that sample was that actually, kids from lower socioeconomic groups had a phone earlier, and kids that were academically disadvantaged, so they weren't doing as well at school, were using their phone before bed more, right? So again, we're talking about correlations here. We're not talking about causations. There might be a damn good reason why poorer kids do have access to smartphones earlier. It might be because mum and dad are still at work when they get home from school, and it's a way of keeping them safe and keeping in contact. And again, that kind of whole idea of kids being left to their own devices, literally, is around when you get that device, what skill training do you get with that? That is the batteries not included. The batteries The batteries of social emotional learning are not included when you get out the device. You're just getting, can you turn it on? Can you download the apps? And can you add tons of friends and make a good TikTok? That's not the skills that we're talking about. Yeah. And a lot of those skills come through your values. It comes through how you communicate. It comes through how you appraise information, whether you have time to appraise information, whether you're working in an industry that requires you to do that, or whether it requires you just to do manual tasks and not really ask too many questions about things like the conditions that you're working in. And this is the problem with poverty and the cycle of poverty that, again, has nothing to do with technology. It has to do with oppression and exhaustion and the machinations of capitalism and power.
You either are used to asking those questions or you're not.
That's right. So in this, I guess lots of teachers and people would be familiar with the four C's of 21st century learning, of collaboration. The fifth one I think we need to add is being able to concentrate, being able to critically think and appraise, and our ability to pay attention and be on task and focused is something that I think we need to add here to those skills of the future. Because if you can't concentrate and pay attention, then are you going to be a valuable worker?
Jocelyn, you've been a fantastic guest. I knew you would be. Thank you so much for joining us on Freedom Matters. We're really, really grateful.
So much fun. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Freedom Matters. If you like what you hear, then subscribe on your favourite platform. And until next time, we wish you happy, healthy, and productive days.